Okay, thanks for coming today. We're going to get going with our study. What we've been talking about is the era in which the New Testament church began to transform. We know from looking at history, we look at the New Testament, we see an informal, almost like a family, not a lot of structure, not a lot of conformity. And then we know from history, when we dig into church history of the Middle Ages, we see this highly structured, hierarchical institution with a lot of rigid teachings. And so we're kind of taking a look at the era in which this transformation took place and trying to learn some things. A lot of different things that we can talk about. Last week, what we surveyed was some of the basic problems, divisions in the church, beginning back in the apostolic age and then moving up to the transition era. Today, what we're going to look at is some historical turning points. And so there's kind of some church history and some secular history that kind of intertwines. And so that's what we're going to kind of take a look at today, because the era in which the church changed significantly from what you see in the New Testament to what you see in the Middle Ages also was an era in which the world changed a lot. A lot of things happened. A lot of tumultuous events happened. So you almost really can't separate them. It's kind of like cause and effect. So today what we'll do is we're going to look at Scripture in 2 Corinthians 10 and then Hebrews 10. And then we'll catch up a little bit from last time, because I didn't finish the outline from last time. So if you have last week's outline handy, you can use that. If you don't, I repeated the part on this week's outline that I didn't get to last time. There's also an extra handout for this week. There's another installment of the chronology. The pink handout back there is the kind of the third installment in the little chronology that I've been giving you, so that you can kind of use that to kind of go along with the class. Phil's going to go ahead and lead us in a time of prayer. Before class, as he tends to do, he was scouting out the scriptures for the week, because he knows that if there are any with difficult names or places or anything in there, I would make him read them. And since there aren't any, I'm just going to have him lead the prayer instead.
God, thank you so much for today, that we can come together to study your word. God, help us, please grow our faith today. Help us to learn to love each other more. Please protect us from the negativity of the world. Help us to keep a positive, loving focus on you. Praise.
Amen. All right. Well, let's just go ahead and start off over in 2 Corinthians 10. This is a passage that will give us some ideas to think about when we look at the things the church goes through the ages, both in our historical study and also taking a look at some things today. The context of this is that Paul, writing to the Corinthians, this is a second epistle, and of course he's dealt with a lot of problems in the church at Corinth, and he's had to sometimes speak very firmly to them about some of the things that they're badly missing. At the same time, he's also expressed his love and affection for them. But what's happened is, and these little references here, chapter 11, verse 5, chapter 12, verse 1, there's this group of authoritarian teachers who were known as the super apostles, who had acquired a large following, and not just in Corinth, but in a lot of places, because they were the kind of people who made a big show of their outward zeal and of their outward knowledge and of their authority over the church. And that kind of person, as Paul says in chapter 11, verse 19, he says, or verse 20, you even put up with people who enslave you or exploit you or take advantage of you or push themselves forward or slap you in the face. To my shame, I admit that we were too weak for that. You know, the church has always been prone to authoritarian leaders. There's always a false security in so-called leaders who will boldly tell you that they know everything, and if you just do things their way, everything will be great. Paul very firmly refused to be like that. He allowed himself to be mocked, and he allowed himself to be slandered, and he allowed himself to be belittled rather than claiming rank, rather than claiming authority, rather than bossing people around. And that's one of the contexts of this passage here in chapter 10. If you could read this for us. Chapter 10, 1 to 5. Yeah, you're right place. Yeah. Chapter 10, 1 to 5. You're right on it.
By the meekness and gentleness of Christ, I appeal to you I, Paul, know timid when face to face with you, but bold when away. I beg you that when I come, I may not have to be as bold as I expect to be toward some people who think that we live by the standards of this world. For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds. We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ.
Very good. Thank you very much. This is a perspective that Paul offers that, of course, has a lot of relevance to the struggles that the church was going through in his own lifetime, but it also provides us a very comprehensive perspective on the troubles and struggles that we deal with today. As I hope you've picked up when we study the ancient church and the things that go on, an awful lot of the stuff that we deal with, an awful lot of the problems that come up, an awful lot of the controversies that come up, have close spiritual parallels in the ancient church. As the writer of Ecclesiastes said, hundreds of years even before Jesus, there is nothing new under the sun. There are new details. There are new ways of committing the same old sins, but they're still the same old sins. There are new terms and new people who create divisions, but it's still the same old problem of division. There are similar spiritual themes at work in problems that on the surface may seem very different. Well, Paul has this lesson that he wants to offer the Corinthians. He says, we don't use the weapons of the world. It's not appropriate for believers in Christ, for believers in the gospel, to use the weapons of the world. Well, what are the weapons of the world? What do you think? What are the weapons of the world?
Oh, intimidation.
Intimidation. Let someone know that they're screwing up if they don't do it your way. Manipulation. Make them feel guilty if you don't do it their way.
Revenge.
Right. If someone did something bad to me, I'm gonna take it out of them now. You have, of course, outright use of force. Yeah, we're gonna get our way because we got more guns than you do. Or the American variant, we're gonna do things our way because we got more votes than you do. It's the same basic, philosophically, it's the same thing. Lloyd?
I can do everything myself. I don't need any help from any higher power of any kind.
Okay, relying on human power, human wisdom. I've figured it all out. I've studied it all out. I've got these credentials, and we're going to do it my way because I know the right way to do things. And if for some reason you don't go along with my way, well, you must be inferior, right? You must have something wrong with you. All these things are weapons of the world. And what Paul is exhorting them to do is instead to continue in faith, genuine faith in Jesus and in grace, the values of the cross. As it so often happens, you just keep coming back to the cross. Well, one of the reasons why the world fights with their kind of weapons is because they're trying to win worldly victories. See, worldly methods will win you worldly victories. And conversely, worldly victories have to be won with worldly methods. If as a church we set ourselves up and set worldly goals, then we're going to have to use worldly methods to get there. If it's important to us to prove that we're the only ones who are right and all these other people out there are scum and snakes, then we're going to have to use worldly methods to do that. We're going to have to intimidate and manipulate people. If we as a church feel like it's important for us to become important and powerful and have influence over secular society and make people take notice of us, then we're going to have to use worldly methods to do that. We didn't mention a favorite worldly method is Lord Dollar, the money. That's another worldly method. Just spend enough money to get your way. The New York Yankees way of winning championships and accomplishing your goals. If you're a sports fan, you know that at the beginning of the season, our national news media were in mourning because the New York Yankees, what are their two darling teams? The Yankees and the Red Sox. Basically, they view the other 28 teams as just there to furnish occasional opposition for the Yankees and the Red Sox. Well, the New York Yankees had one of their best players, their ace relief pitcher. He was horsing around in the outfield and ripped his leg apart, and he was out for the season. Oh, no, the poor Yankees. What a bad break. What a terrible break. Well, they had gone out and bought up some other team's best relief pitchers who are just sitting there doing nothing. Well, they just take one of these other guys that they're already paying millions of dollars. They just paid the guy, this kid, other kid that they bought from Tampa Bay, just so Tampa Bay wouldn't have him, is the only reason they did it, because they were a rival. Well, that's the way the world does things, buying stuff up, intimidating people, pushing themselves forward. And Paul says a lot of the reasons why we have these worldly methods is because we have worldly goals. And so he says that there's a genuine standard of victory. The genuine standard of Christian victory, he describes at the end of the passage that Dot read. Did you catch this here in verse 5? What's the goal of using spiritual methods and spiritual weapons, if you want to put it that way? Take every thought captive, make it obedient to Christ. This is spiritual victory. Make every thought obedient to Christ. In other words, take every thought, every goal, every hope that you have, and tie it back to Jesus and the cross. When we look at ourselves as a church, in our ministries, tie it back to the values of the cross, not to worldly goals. Don't let people force us into worldly goals like, well, how much money do you have, and how big is your church, and do you have the right positions on things, and are you involved in the stuff you should be involved in? Come back to, are we obedient to Christ? Are our thoughts obedient to Christ? Are our goals centered on faith and grace and compassion and trust and the ability to communicate these things to other people? That will help us to reconsider some of the methods that we use. A lot of the times people just simply arbitrarily set in their heads, well, the church is supposed to be like this, and therefore we have to do whatever we need to get it that way. But if you don't question and critically evaluate your goals against the values of the cross, then it's no wonder why we end up with worldly methods using all this variety of things that we were talking about. Let's go over to Hebrews chapter 10, one other kind of theme scripture for the day. This is a passage I think is probably a little more familiar, although a lot of times there's a couple of verses in here that you might be familiar with without really having ever taken a detailed look at the full context. We're not going to read the whole passage here just because we'll run out of time, and I can do that on my own without a lot of help. So we're just going to read a couple of excerpts here. Lloyd, could you go Hebrews 10, 19 to 25, and then Peggy, could you read verses 32 to 39 for us?
Therefore, brothers, since we have confidence to enter the most holy place by the blood of Jesus, by a new and living way opened for us through the curtain, that is his body, and since we have a great priest over the house of God, let us draw near to God with a sincere heart and full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled to cleanse us from a guilty conscience, and having our bodies washed with pure water. Let us hold unswervingly to the hope we profess, for he who promised is faithful. And let us consider how we may spur one another on towards love and good deeds. Let us not give up meeting together, as some have or some are in the habit of doing, but let us encourage one another, and all the more as you see the day approaching.
Remember those earlier days after you have received the word, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so stupid. You sympathized with those who prayed and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. So do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay, but my righteous one will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him.
Excellent. Thank you very much. Actually, I guess I cut you off a verse short, but sorry about that. Go ahead. Why don't you read the last part of it there? I don't want to deprive you of your verse.
That we are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved.
Thank you very much. That's very good. Just to notice some of the verbs in here. It talks about having confidence, talks about drawing near to God, talks about holding unswervingly to our hope, talks about spurring one another on, talks about standing your ground, talks about don't throw away your confidence, persevering, continuing, and it talks about not shrinking back. Do you know the context of the book of Hebrews? Do you know the general problem that was being addressed in the book of Hebrews? Your dad would go on, Eric, your dad would be able to give a lengthy exposition of this. I've heard him do some very good lessons on Hebrews. Yeah, it was written to a group of Jewish believers who had become discouraged with Christianity because it didn't seem to accomplish the things they hoped it would. And they were thinking, maybe we should go back to the old law. The old law gave us structure. The old law told us exactly when we were doing the right thing and when we were doing the wrong thing. It's human nature. When things go wrong, what do you always think? I must be doing something wrong. And when things go right, you think, I must be doing something right. And one of the things the book of Hebrews was written was to cure us of that. See, having outward results doesn't prove we're doing the right thing. And having problems and struggles doesn't prove that we're messing up. It's whether or not we've taken every thought obedient to Christ, whether every goal and thought and method and teaching connects back to the grace and the faith and the love of the cross. That's what tells us whether we're on the right track. Outward results can be very deceptive in both directions. You know the old poem by Rudyard Kipling, if you can endure success and failure and realize they're both imposters, because that's what they both are. Even in the church, even in ministry, the results that we have don't always tell us whether we're doing the right thing or not, because God lets us goof up 100,000 ways and still enjoy some positive things because he's gracious. And conversely, we can do all the right things and still struggle and suffer because the world is very harsh and cruel. And that's really what we're experiencing. When things go well, the lesson is God's being gracious. When we struggle, it's the world is not very gracious. It's never a reflection necessarily on whether we're doing the right thing or the wrong thing. Well, what he teaches us in Hebrews in this first passage, and we'll just synopsize it, of course, but this first passage says, draw near to God with a clear conscience. And it's one of the fundamental differences between serving God by law and serving God by grace, is that if you serve God by grace, you can have an absolutely clear conscience because you know that your standing with God does not depend on your own righteousness, whether you're talking about your righteous actions or righteous knowledge or righteous belief or anything. You have had, as he says, you've had your bodies washed with pure water and your heart sprinkled to cleanse you from the guilty conscience. In other words, spiritual confidence comes from where? Comes from God and from God's grace. That's where spiritual confidence comes from. A lot of the struggles that we have with worldly thinking and worldly actions and worldly methods is because we're trying to get fleshly confidence. We may be doing it with a spiritual veneer, but we're trying to get confidence from what we've accomplished. Oh, I feel good about my relationship with God because I've done this and I've done that. I know this and I know that. And I know I'm better than those other people here. And so we are engaged in this constant competition to kind of keep at least above average, if not at the very top. And this is the wrong kind of confidence. This is the kind of false confidence that these poor, struggling believers to whom are being addressed in Hebrews, that's why they feel so bad, because they're seeking the wrong kind of confidence. Whereas you can have a clear conscience anytime you realize that you can't only get it through grace. You can only get it by trusting in the cross, that you really have been forgiven of your sins. And that is the kind of genuine encouragement that we get from the cross. Not encouragement through, well, we can accomplish this, we can do this because God's powerful, and because I want to do this, he'll let me do it because he's powerful and he wants to show that he can do it. But God has forgiven me, he accepts me, regardless of how many things I'm able to do or not do. He's able to make me stand before him by his grace because he loves me no matter what I'm doing, no matter what I'm like. That gives you genuine encouragement and true spiritual confidence. And it's also, and we're kind of skipping this passage in the middle, it's also what gives you hope of better things. I will point out, you have this passage in the middle right there, it says, if we deliberately go on sinning after receiving the knowledge of the truth. And that's usually misunderstood to say that if you keep goofing up after you become a Christian, you're in real trouble. It's usually used as a club to beat people over the head with if they're struggling with sin. It has absolutely nothing to do with that. It has absolutely nothing to do with struggling with sin. What it's talking about is if you hear the message of the cross, the fact that you can have your sins just forgiven by grace, and you reject that, and you insist on going your own way, trying to justify yourself by law, then you're stuck. You have nothing better. You have no hope. That's what that passage is talking about. Go back and look at it in that light. We're not going to cover it in detail. I can get myself in enough trouble as it is. Verse 32 to 39 tells us that we have, if we have the right kind of confidence, spiritual confidence, confidence through faith and grace, then we also have the hope of better things. And you'll notice that the things that he talks about, again, don't fixate on the specific things that he tells them to do. He gives them some examples. You know, remember when you were publicly exposed to persecution and you could just take it. Well, that may or may not apply to us. Remember that you joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property. Well, we may have other ways of suffering for the cross. But what he's pointing out is, he's saying, remember when you went through those things, you were close to the cross. It's not saying you have to go out and provoke ways of suffering. It's saying that when you do suffer, remember that you're close to the cross, because that's what Jesus went through. When you endure injustice, when you're slandered, when you're mistreated, when you're misunderstood, or even if just people just squinch up their face at you and give you what Richard Rogers calls the Church of Christ stare because you're teaching things they haven't heard before, even if that's all it is, you are close to the cross, because that's what Jesus went through. Jesus stuck to faith and grace and simply endured whatever the world wanted to throw at him. And that is how we learn the hope of better things. He says, don't shrink back from that. Don't give up on that. It's always going to be uncomfortable and unpleasant, but you don't have to shrink back from it. This is what the climax of that passage is. Don't shrink back from doing the right things. Don't shrink back from living by grace. Don't shrink back by living by faith. The world is going to try to get you to do that. Don't shrink back and settle for something second best. Don't shrink back and settle for some worldly method or some legal method, because it's not going to give you what you really hoped it would give you. Now, got to catch up a little bit. Last week, I know this is just shocking that I would do this, but I didn't finish the class outline last week. Last week, I wanted to cover, before we move on to the history of the later years of the ancient church, I did mention, I keep mentioning this date, AD 312. Now, why do I, have you caught this just yet? Why do I keep mentioning AD 312? Constantine became emperor, and that's significant because he became a Christian right after he became an emperor. So it's kind of a dividing point in Christian history. And it changed the church a lot after Constantine became emperor. And that's actually today's topic. But I actually wanted to mention a couple things that were already happening before that, because human nature is always the same. Human nature always has the same basic temptations, always the same basic struggles. After the emperor became a Christian, which of course, that's kind of like the fantasy that a lot of people have in the church today. Oh, wouldn't it be great if the president would be a Christian, would force everyone to obey our beliefs and would enforce our beliefs on everybody, and he'd whip these homosexuals into shape, and he'd whip these socialists into shape, and he'd toss these people into prison if they don't agree with this. It sounds great. In actuality, if you believe that the church is an institution and an organization with its own goals and its own agendas, then yeah, that's a very good thing. Because Constantine was very good. If you measured the church in terms of numbers, in terms of the number of people who called themselves Christians, it skyrocketed after the emperor became a Christian. If you measure the church in terms of its success and its appearance, then having an emperor as a Christian was a great thing. The church all of a sudden went from struggling in poverty to being wealthy beyond their wildest dreams. But if you evaluate the church in terms of, is it faithful to the values of the cross, then having the emperor become a Christian was a horrible thing. It was a disaster. It changed the church in ways that made it unrecognizable from the church in the New Testament. But the point here is, in the catch-up section, it's not blamable on Constantine. One man can never do that. No one person can ever cause that much damage. Even if you look at the great villains of history, Lenin, Hitler, whoever you care to name, They are never solely responsible for all those horrors. All that one person can ever do is play on desires that people already had, anger that people already had, resentment and prejudice that people already had. And this is, just as Frank likes to say, this won't cost you anything. This is why it's so important for us not to get angry and upset and boiling with annoyance and frustration at the world, no matter how bad their problems are, because it's so easy for someone to come along and channel that into something horrible. Adolf Hitler was only playing on a lot of rage and resentment and prejudice that had already been there long before, and he was just exploiting it. Lenin was just playing on a lot of resentment and a lot of desires that were already there, and he just exploited it. Napoleon Bonaparte, the same thing. Genghis Khan, the same thing. Any villain you care to name. I don't know whether that applies to Art Modell or not. I'll let the Browns fans decide that. But one person can only do so much damage. One person can only do the damage that's made possible by the situation that already exists, formed by millions of other people's desires and selfishness and poor perspective. And the same thing is true of Constantine. And actually, Constantine started out with very good intentions. We'll get there in a few minutes. But even before AD 312, there were already some things that you could call some early warning signs in the church. And if you read the writings of the ancient Christians, as I know you all do in your spare time, I've spent a lot of my time reading them and slogging through a lot of stuff, so why shouldn't you have to listen to a few minutes of it? But actually, it can be very instructive. You can read all the way back in about AD 100, you can have some early warning signs, because you can read that by this time, the church was starting to kind of become an institution already. Even though it was being persecuted, even though it was unpopular, you can read a lot of things that people were already at that time thinking of the church as an institution, as an organization. There was this change called the monoepiscopacy, which is, I mentioned the word because I try not to give you too many of these words, but if you read books on the subject, and I hope you will at least crack open a history book or something once in a while, you'll see this word. And it just means the one bishop system. And this was really one of the first major changes from the New Testament teachings that you see historically in the church. By AD 100, it was very common for churches to have appointed one person in charge, unlike what you see in the New Testament, where there's a group of elders, group of deacons, and at that time, not established preachers like we tend to have today. Well, by AD 100, you can see writings where a lot of the people at that time are thinking, now, it's very important for us not to let the church change too much. It's very important for us to protect what the church has become. This is now almost 70 years since the death of Christ. The apostles have passed from the scene. People have been brought up now in the church instead of the church being brand new. And when you're brought up in something, you tend to view it as the way it's got to be. It's just human nature. It's not a reflection on anybody's character or blaming anybody over and above anyone else. It's human nature. By this time, the church is now into the second or third generation. If you read the writings of, for example, Ignatius of Antioch, who wrote a lot of very famous epistles, almost every one of them, he says, now obey the bishop. Do what he tells you, even if you don't like it. It's very important that we not let the church get to change into something else. Very important that we not let the church have too many different points of view or anything like that. We don't want that. We don't want people thinking for themselves. Now, that's kind of a danger sign. And that's because it's kind of a cause and effect. This monoepiscopacy, it developed for very rational reasons. Now, you know that in the New Testament, you have churches, and we'll just say kind of crosses here are just different churches of loosely organized believers in various places like we see in the New Testament. We know that they had two big problems from the very beginning. You had your false teachers, right? Which we'll symbolize by a little snake here. That's a false teacher right there. And you had persecutors, right? Which will, just to make my wife happy, we'll symbolize as a dinosaur here. Well, you have the persecutors and you have the false teachers. And what happens is the false teachers would come along and gobble up some of these little churches. So you have a nice fat snake now, and it ate some of the churches. And then you have the dino come along, the persecutors, and wipe out a couple other churches. So now you got a fat, happy dinosaur. Well, people took the wrong lesson for this. Instead of listening to what we read in these scriptures, keep your confidence in your faith and in God's grace. Don't fight with the weapons of the world. They started thinking, we need to toughen up a little bit. We need to stop having this wimpy leadership with a bunch of old guys who just sit around and talk about our problems until they come to a consensus on things. We need strong men. And that's a human desire. That's a natural human desire. When you're not happy with things, you want a strong man. You want someone to come along and say, we're going over here, come with me. You want someone to say, we're doing it like this, do it my way, you know, my way or the highway. There's always a false admiration for that, even amongst Christians. And so what happened is churches would start appointing either a powerful or respected elder or an eloquent preacher as their bishop. They started using the word bishop in a different sense that it's used in the New Testament. Originally, the word bishop just the same as over, just Latin word for overseer is all it is. But they started putting one person in charge. So now, if someone came along, a false teacher or a persecutor, instead of the individual Christians having to reason through and come up with their response, they would just let the bishop tell them what to do. They'd just say, okay, guys, this guy's right, we're going to do it his way, or this guy's wrong, we're not going to do it his way. And it relieved everyone of the trouble of thinking, relieved everyone of the trouble of having their own relationship with God where they had to work through stuff like that. And that is something that there's a part of human nature that finds that very desirable. It produces a strong sense of false security. Well, there's also an inevitable next step, because as the individual churches began to appoint a strong man leader, some of the individual churches started to think, you know, we're just this little church out here in Podunkville, and even though we got our strong man, it'd be kind of nice if our strong man had a strong man. And so what happened is the churches in the smaller cities started looking towards the churches in the bigger cities. How about if you be over us? How about if when we have a problem we can't handle here in Podunkville, you take care of it up in Rome for us? How would that be? Well, if you're already in charge of the church at Rome and you get these other people coming up to you asking to be in charge of them, what are you going to say? Well, human nature being what it is, sure, no problem. Of course, you gotta kind of come forth with a little bit of tribute to me here. You're going to kind of have to come a little bit the other direction here, aren't you? But eventually, what happened is, this is where we come in at the time of Constantine. You had churches in the big cities would have their bishop who would be over the bishops in several other cities. And already by the time of Constantine, you had the bishops in the big cities were already competing for who would get to be under them, who they'd get to be in charge of. And in Europe especially, this had already become pretty highly structured, Europe and even in Asia. The only churches that really held out against this were the North African churches. The North African churches resisted this for a long, long time. But the European and Asian churches both found this a very convenient system, because you have a problem in your church, whoever we've appointed, you know, we appoint someone extremely popular that everybody trusts and we know is real tough and firm and strong, you know, someone like Ted, you know, who we know is going to intimidate everybody. And any problem that comes up, Ted, can you tell us what to do? And if Ted's got the answer, he says, yeah, you do it this way, and we all go do it. Once in a while, Ted says, I'm not so sure. Let's go talk to the guy up in Cleveland. And then we go talk to him. He tells Ted what to do. Ted tells us what to do. Everybody's happy, right? Well, that solves problems real quick. It answers questions real quick. But it gets you away from the values of the cross real quick, is what happens. Instead of each of us having our own relationship with God, now what do we have? We've got a relationship with our tough guy, Ted. And instead of a relationship with God, Ted's got a relationship with his senior tough guy up in Cleveland or Detroit or wherever he's allied himself to. And this happened long before the empire took over Christianity. And you can see that this is the roots of what ultimately became the papacy. This is what eventually by the Middle Ages became the Pope at the top, and then the cardinals, and then the archbishops, and then the bishops. That's the way it developed. You can see it developed for very natural reasons. There never was a time when someone woke up and said, I think I'm going to be Pope, and I'm going to have a few guys under me and a few guys under him. it happened because people wanted it. People desired it, and it happened very naturally. And at the same time, you had the rise of what you usually call orthodoxy. Because once you got one guy in charge of the church, he tends to make the church the way he wants it to be. Sometimes he's going to use his power to do the right things, isn't he? Just by accident. And sometimes it's going to be to do things the way he wanted to be. Imagine what it would be like if all of a sudden, I'm kind of joking about Ted because he's such a tough guy and so intimidating and everything, but we wouldn't actually put him in charge because he's a very modest person. What if you guys had some fit of insanity and put me in charge of the church? Well, some things would actually might be good, but you know what would happen is you'd walk in here next Sunday morning and the auditorium, the baptistry would be open and there'd be ducks and geese splashing around in there, and you'd go to sit down in the pew and there'd be squirrels and rabbits racing around in the pews. See, I would give in to that for a few, I would hold off from doing that for a few weeks, but eventually I'd give in to it. Eventually, if you gave me unlimited power, I couldn't resist bringing in the ducks and the geese, no matter how much it upset my brother Lloyd. That's what human nature is. You can deal with power for a very short period of time at the most, but eventually you're going to start using it to get things your way. And this is what happens with orthodoxy. This is how you ended up with the church in the Middle Ages, where they were extremely intolerant of anything that went against what the Pope said, anything that went against what the bishops said. You also notice that at this time they began to reinterpret the ministries of the church and the activities of the church as having authority not from God but from the church. During the era even before Constantine, you had the problem of baptism, for example, began to be taught as you need to be baptized because the church says you need to be baptized, and the church says you need to be baptized this particular way, and you need to say these particular things before you're baptized, and you need to do these particular things after you're baptized. Once you have this kind of hierarchical system, all of a sudden everything starts to serve the needs of the organization instead of the needs of the individuals. And it's true of every human organization. It's true of not just churches. It's true of companies. It's true of education. It's even true of labor unions. It's true of religious groups. It's true of the government. It's true of everything. Every human organization, once you start building up a hierarchy, everything starts to serve the interests of the people at the top. It's true of where I work. Where I work, there's people at the top who make lots of money, who have big, huge offices, who are always get everything that they want, and they do nothing. They are good at two things. They're good at taking credit for things other people do, and deflecting blame for their mess ups, for their mistakes. And I, being the fool that I am, I'm down at the very bottom of the hierarchy where I work. And what I always get is the way things work there is some problem will come up, and some person at the bottom will find out about this problem, but they're not allowed to do anything about it. So they'll talk to their superior, who will talk to their superior. So I, being one of the clowns down at the bottom, I'm always getting these emails. You know those email strings, with 15 different emails copied there, and I read through it, and it's come from somebody way up at the top who kicked it down to somebody below him, who kicked it down to somebody below him, and it got all the way down to me. And then I look further, and before it got up to the guy at the top, it trickled up from someone down here. Someone down here kicked it up, and it was up to the top, and it comes down to the bottom. And usually it's some ridiculous thing that could have been solved if the original person just had the simple foresight to ask a couple of questions and take a little initiative. We had this huge stink once because this student went to class and they saw this sign. It said the 130 class has moved to room 200 or some such thing, I don't remember, 246. And this student had class like at 3:30, and they come in and they see this sign. My class has been moved to 1:30. Well, that's not what it says, is it? But that's what they thought, students being students. This is why they go to college. This also, as Frank says, this won't cost you anything. You don't actually learn many useful facts in college, but you learn how to become an adult. That's what it's for. Well, this student goes to their advisor. My class has been moved from 3:30 to 1:30. The advisor, instead of calling us up, instead of checking, they just report to their supervisor. The math department moved to class without telling the students. That person told their supervisor, the math department moved to class without telling their students. And this complaint went up to the top, until some very powerful parasite got a hold of it and decided to exert his authority. He yelled at the person below him, "The math department moved to class without telling the students." That person yelled at the person below him, "The math department moved to class without telling the students." And eventually, where does it get? Well, to this poor clown in our department who deals with problems like this, because he's, I don't know what this problem is, but I get this problem, all these people yelling, and I go and I, this is why I am where I am in the world. Instead of yelling at somebody, I actually go and look at the sign. The 3:30 class wasn't moved. It's right where it was supposed to be. The student misread the sign. It's okay. Well, of course, then I get yelled at by everybody. How can you say it's okay when you move classes without telling the students? You know, but that's a different, learning disabilities is a different lesson right there. That's the nature of hierarchies. That is what it's like. That is the nature of things when you allow people to get human power. Okay. What happened when Constantine became the emperor? Well, Constantine's victory came about for a lot of historical reasons that don't really concern us that much. It's an irony. In AD 311, the Roman Empire was ruled by Galerius, a fanatical persecutor of Christians. And by the way, your pink chronology will go into much more detail about this. If you picked up the little pink sheet, this will give you a lot more history than I'm going to cover in the class. When Galerius died, there were several people who thought that they deserved to be emperor. And human nature being it was, they fought with the weapons of the world to decide who would be emperor. They had this big civil war. Constantine emerged victorious. Now, Constantine was an interesting guy. He was very power hungry. He wanted to be emperor, and he wanted to be emperor bad enough to hire troops to fight the other people who wanted to be emperor. But he was more of a philosophical kind of guy. For several months, he had been very interested in Christianity. He had become very curious, why do these Christians, with their wacko religion, why do they let people kill them and beat them up? Why do they do this? So he'd studied it a lot, secretly. And the night before the climactic battle, when he won the Civil War, the Battle of Milvian Bridge for you historians, the night before the battle, he told people he had this dream. He saw this giant cross, and he heard a voice say, "In this sign you will conquer." So in his mind, he won and became emperor because of his interest in Christianity. Now, there's no doubt that he was sincere. You know, whether it was true, right or not, I don't know. Nobody knows. There's no doubt he was sincere, because what would you gain from all of a sudden embracing an unpopular religion that everyone thought was weirdos? So there's no doubt he was sincere. And at the beginning, as Marge Schott would say, he was good at the beginning. He just went too far. He wanted to use his position as emperor. He learned as much as he could about Christianity, and he wanted to help Christians without hurting anybody else. So one of the first things he did in AD 313, the Edict of Milan, he removed all laws against Christianity, all at a shot, all the laws against Christians being a Christian. They were all removed. Christians now were fully legal no matter what. He also, a few years later, he declared the first day of the week, what we call Sunday, to be a holiday. I mentioned before, in the very early church, Sunday was not a day of rest. In the Roman Empire, you had to work 7 days a week. Roman Empire, there were only like a half a dozen holidays the whole year. So Constantine said, I want my brothers and sisters to be able to worship on Sunday without having to get up early in the morning and then go to work afterwards. So he made Sunday a holiday. And of course, it benefited everybody. Benefited all working class Romans. The first time they'd ever had a day off every week. It was great. It was better than having a labor union, having this guy declare this day off. The problem came in when the emperor decided that it wasn't enough just to benefit the church. He wanted to start leading the church. All the stuff I've done for them, you know, I really ought to now have a little bit of authority here. We talked last week about Donatus. Now, Donatus was a divisive troublemaker, so he deserved what the emperor did to him. But the problem was that all of a sudden, by dealing with problems through force, all of a sudden you're getting away from the values of the cross. You're getting away from the grace of the cross. The controversy with Arius, the council at Nicaea, another example. We would probably think that Arius was wrong about everything. Arius was a teacher who said that Jesus, it's not possible for God's Son to be a fleshly being. That just doesn't make sense. Jesus was just a really good guy. Jesus was a really good guy who lived a perfect life, and it's great. And that teaching became very popular. So popular that the emperor decided to stamp it out. We would certainly say Arius was wrong. But by the emperor just saying, we're going to have this council, and the council is going to declare you a heretic and kick you and your followers out of the church, all of a sudden, it's dealing with the problem that way sets a precedent. Once you start dealing with problems that way, just kick them out if they're causing trouble, all of a sudden it's hard to go back to being gracious to people. It's hard to go back to being patient and being faithful and being compassionate. And so the emperor's influence began to grow. And very soon, what happened is, instead of just stopping at persecuting people within the church who had the wrong beliefs, started persecuting people outside the church who had the wrong beliefs. Started cracking down on unbelievers. They started taking away legal rights from people who weren't Christians. They started taking away civil rights from people who weren't Christians. And this eventually translated itself to Constantine's successors. One of the ironies about his successors is that for several decades, this guy Arius and his followers still remained pretty popular for a while. And Constantine had a son, Constantius, who became emperor a few years after Constantine died. And he liked Arian's teachings. And so for several decades, you'd have a Nicene Christian as an emperor, and then an Arian Christian as an emperor, and they'd alternate, and they would fight within the church. You know, they'd always benefit their faction. And what happened was people started to, instead of just sticking with the teachings of the scriptures, they would start going back and forth depending on what the emperor believed. There were lots of people who became opportunists. Christianity all of a sudden became the way to get ahead in your career. But of course, not enough to become a Christian. You really wanted to get ahead. You had to keep track of whether the emperor was Nicene or Arian. And then you'd really be in good shape right there. Well, there was one emperor called Julian the Apostate for about 2 years. He was an unbeliever. He was Constantine's nephew. He was emperor for about 2 years. It very briefly relaxed this kind of stuff. But as soon as he died, AD 63, they just went full force. And human nature being what it is, see, the Romans used to persecute Christians because they thought they were troublemakers. The Christian emperors persecuted unbelievers because they thought that we are right and they are wrong. And that can be a much more frightening motivation to persecute people. And the Roman persecutions of unbelievers got a lot nastier than the persecutions of Christians ever had been. Now, the final decline of the Western Empire, we're going to cover this in a lot more detail. But I just wanted to mention things right now. After this period when the Christian emperors take over and they start getting involved in the affairs of the church, it's interesting, it coincides with the final decline of Rome. Now, Rome, for about 100 years before Constantine, had been really struggling. The 3rd century, the 200s, was a time of great weakness in Rome. They were under constant danger of internal collapse and being invaded from outside. This guy Diocletian that I mentioned last time put through these incredibly sweeping reforms that probably saved Rome for a couple more centuries. And so Constantine inherited this empire that just not long before had been strengthened, had been reformed. And so the empire kind of had a newfound strength, which these so-called Christian emperors used to make the church what they wanted it to be. They divided it into East and West, which is important because even when the Western Empire fell, there actually was an Eastern Roman Empire that lasted well into the Middle Ages, and we'll talk about that later. That's where the Eastern Orthodox Church comes in, which we'll get to a little bit later. But through the late 4th century and into the 5th century, what happened is Rome kept getting attacked by the so-called barbarian tribes along their borders. And the Christian emperors just couldn't handle it. They didn't know what to do. They were too busy arguing about whether the Father, the Son, and the Spirit are three persons from one substance or one person in three substances to be able to figure out how to keep the empire from being invaded. And it's a real irony that if you read people from the 5th century AD, as I know you all do in your spare time, there's a huge debate over, is the empire's collapse Christianity's fault? It's a fascinating discussion that a lot of people thought the old gods were having their revenge. A lot of people thought that the reason these emperors are so incompetent is because they're Christians and they can't handle things. Very interesting, and we'll get to that later. But just to briefly mention, the church was transformed by all this. One way, new motivations to become a Christian. Until AD 312, no matter how much trouble the church was having, and they were having problems, everybody who was a Christian before AD 312, it's because they really believed it. Because there was no other reason to become a Christian. Even though they were having problems, even though I've criticized them for some of the things the church was doing, everyone who was a Christian before the 312 really believed in the cross. After AD 312, a lot of new reasons to become a Christian. the church was flooded with opportunists. The church was flooded with rich people, political opportunists, politicians of all kinds, because all of a sudden that became the way to get ahead. And that can't help but changing the church. And just something to think about when you want powerful people to get involved in the church today, just something to think about the effects that can have. Much worse, they went from being the persecuted to being the persecutors. There again, it's human nature. We got the power. They used to shove us around. We're going to do the shoving now. 1 Corinthians 6 tells us, hey, why not rather be the ones who are wronged? Why not rather be the ones who are persecuted? It's better to be the persecuted if you're going to live with the values of the cross. They also started rewriting the past. This is, in fact, where you get a lot of the lurid tales of exaggerating the persecutions of the past. And a lot of Christians today, ironically, have an exaggerated view of the persecutions of the early church. Because in reality, the persecutions of the early church by the Romans were very sporadic. Just every once in a while, an emperor would take it into his head to boost his popularity rating by killing a few Christians. It's after the emperors took over the church, they kind of rewrote the past and blamed a lot of things on their early predecessors. They just persecuted us relentlessly all that time. They deserve it if we go out and persecute them now. These pagan religions were responsible for so many bad things. We need to crack down on them now. And it's ironic that a lot of people, even in our own fellowship, believe a lot of things that were written by the medieval church to try to justify all the persecution against unbelievers. They also made up a lot of myths about things that happened to the apostles, a lot of myths of the things that happened to the great religious figures of the past, a lot of the relics that are worshipped in a lot of denominations today, to justify their way of turning the church into an institution. Now, not everyone is happy with this. The term that you find in the 5th century, there are a few Christian writers who talk about the shadow church, or the church within a church, the believers who were not happy with this change. And it was a tough position. They chose, by and large, not to leave the church, but to stick with it and to try to be the voice for the cross, the voice for grace, the voice for faith. And ironically, they were heavily persecuted. They were really mistreated by the emperor's goons. And it's an interesting period because, in a sense, this is what we at least try to do today, is to try to stick true to the teachings of the New Testament in the face of opposition. But in reality, the real test is not so much are you standing up for the right factual things, but are you using the right weapons? Are you using faith and grace instead of the weapons of the world? Little trivia question. We'll finish this up and then we'll let you go. A little potpourri trivia for those of you who like British royalty and so forth. Which of these is the highest rank? Is it a baron? Is it a knight? Is it an earl? Is it a count? Or is it a duke? Well, I've got a book at home that has this huge chart. It goes on for pages of who's in charge of who. And it includes not just those, but the son of an earl and the daughter of a duke. Who takes precedent? You know, it goes all these little things and all these offices and things. Well, of those, the duke is the highest. There's a duke, and then under a duke is another one called a marquis or a marquis, called marquis in England, called a marquis in France. And then you come to an earl. Earl is the same as in other countries, it's called a count. And then underneath the earl, you have what's called a viscount. And then you have the baron. And then you have the knights. So you can see how close you were depending on which one you guessed. Now, as I said, I've got a book that has a much more detailed chart. It goes on for pages. This is human nature. Human nature wants to know, am I higher than you or are you higher than me? If you're higher than me, I'll grovel and I'll suck up to you so that you do things for me. If I'm higher than you, you got to grovel. You got to do things my way. That's the way the world is. And when you look at the silliness of British society, the so-called modern country that still wastes this huge proportion of their economy on these parasites who don't do anything. They have these titles because their great-great-great-great-grandfather fought in the Crusades or something. And their families had to do no constructive work ever since. And it's bizarre that this advanced modern country still has this huge weight on its economy. And then, like us, they still wonder why they have problems with unemployment and crime and things like that. But it's human nature. And the point is, in the church, it's human nature in the church to want to draw distinctions and build a hierarchy and decide who's smarter than me and I listen to them, who am I smarter than and I get to tell them what to do. And the point of the cross is everybody's equal at the cross. Everybody's saved by the same grace. Everybody has the same faith in the same God. God wants us all to know Him equally and sit at His feet and learn equally. And so a lot of these other problems that we're going to learn about, the decline of the church, they come from this basic disorder of turning the church into an institution, into a hierarchy, because that aggravates all the other problems that are there. There were a lot of other problems before this started happening, but the Christians were still faithful. They were still Christians because they wanted to be Christians. But once a church becomes an organization with its own agendas and its own needs, that's when you really start to have, it's almost impossible to stay true to the values of the cross. So if you don't get anything else from the class today, that's kind of the final lesson there. We'll pick up next week. Thanks a lot for your patience.